WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we complete our series on presidents and presidential politics. We begin with historian Rick Perlstein, whose book Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, was published earlier this year. Perlstein's book is an evocative trip through the 60s and early 70s, and an assessment of the impact of Richard Nixon's political career. Perlstein argues that many of the deep divisions of modern American politics were drawn in that period and effectively exploited by Nixon. Perlstein's previous book was Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. I spoke to him in May when Nixonland was first published. Well, Rick Perlstein, welcome to Fresh Air. This book is a great read. It's sort of a fascinating ride through the late 60s and early 70s, sort of seen centered on the career of Richard Nixon. Let's talk a little bit about Nixon's early life. You say that he was a serial collector of resentments. What resentments did he collect growing up?
Well, he was a real loner. According to the early oral histories, he wouldn't ride on the school bus because he thought the other kids smelled. He was very lonely. He spent all his time up in his father's. His father had a grocery store in a former church, and he would go up into the bell tower and read and read and read and read and read. And by the time he made it to college, he was working three times harder than everyone else. He was very smart, and he received a scholarship to Harvard. And he never went to Harvard. He never went to Harvard because his family basically couldn't afford the train ticket from Whittier. They couldn't afford to send him there from Whittier, California, the small Quaker town in Southern California where he grew up. So he went to this local school, Whittier, which was a fine school, but, you know, was not Harvard, which he bore anger and resentment towards the rest of his life. I mean, you can hear him raging about it on the Nixon tapes. And when he got to Whittier, the first thing he did as kind of young man on the make was try to join the school's one fraternity, which were called the Franklins. And they wouldn't let him in. He was too uncool. So he started his own fraternity. His own fraternity was called the Orthogonians, which he said meant upright or upstanding. And basically, he created a fraternity for the uncool kids. And this turned out to be a brilliant way to charter his political career. Soon he was the student body president. And the secret of his success was that the uncool people in society outnumber the cool people. And someone who speaks to their resentments at being looked down upon could reap a harvest of popularity, which is what he did all through his career and every step of the way. He later would call that group of people the silent majority.
Let's move forward a bit. Your book really focuses on the years, I guess, in between like 1966 and 1972. And you note that you describe 1964, which was the year that Goldwater, of course, lost in a landslide election to Lyndon Johnson, as a liberal apotheosis, an apparent national liberal consensus. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, that was what the pundits said at the time. Lyndon Johnson won with about 61% of the vote. And when Lyndon Johnson was nominated, he basically had a 2-to-1 majority of progressives or liberals in the Senate. And they passed the Senate and the House of Representatives. And they passed, you know, the great social legislation that we're still, you know, enjoying, I would say, today. Medicare, Medicaid, the NEA, the NEH, the first environmental legislation, legal aid, of course. And the culmination of that, the absolute apotheosis of the apotheosis, was the Voting Rights Act.
So there was a sense of tolerance and consensus in the land. Now, we go to 1968, and things are very different. I mean, America is roiling with cultural trends which are disturbing to a lot of people. And you know, you describe a point before the New Hampshire primary of 1968. And this struck me as sort of, again, just an example of what some of the roiling social conflicts that were going on. You'd had the Newark riots the year before, 30-some-odd people killed. A report came out on urban riots, the Kerner Commission, in February. On February 17th, The Black Panthers gather to celebrate Huey Newton's birthday, and one of them, James Forman, advocates killing police, sheriffs, and southern governors. That's widely reported. At a police chief's convention, they were displaying armored personnel carriers to deal with civil unrest. And into that climate, we have Richard Nixon staging his comeback. Tell us how he exploited some of that atmosphere, those fears and anxieties, in maneuvering his way to the presidency.
Well, at first he didn't, and that certainly baffled me at first. I mean, the tail end of the story about the signing of the Voting Rights Act was 5 days later were the Watts riots, you know, and they were seen live on TV because KTLA, the television station in Los Angeles, was the first station to have a news helicopter. And in 1966, Lyndon Johnson proposed what was supposed to be the third triumphant apotheosis-like civil rights bill. And this was a civil rights bill that had as its centerpiece an open housing amendment, that an open housing title that would make it illegal to say, I'm not going to rent my house to someone because they're the wrong race. And that year, it went up in flames. I mean, it basically the whole notion that we had this kind of tolerant nation that was passing more and more civil rights legislation just went up in smoke. And the reason it probably went up in smoke was because of all the riots that broke out in city after city, in Cleveland, in Chicago, and even places like Des Moines. Richard Nixon was very busy in 1966. It really was the pivotal year of his comeback. He campaigned for tons and tons and tons of congressional candidates. He worked his tail off. And so he campaigned in city after city after city, and he never mentioned this stuff. He never mentioned the backlash. People like Ronald Reagan and people like George Wallace, the respectively governors, gubernatorial candidate for California governor and the governor of Alabama would mention it all the time. And Nixon didn't mention it, I think, because he knew he had to reestablish his reputation as a statesman and not a gutter snipe. But by 1968, when you get things like the Kerner Commission report, he kind of pivots and he goes all in. And that's when he starts giving speeches about how we have to crush these insurrections by any means necessary, and really kind of casts himself as kind of the field general in the culture war.
Yeah, now he was facing some tough Republican opposition for the Republican presidential nomination. John Lindsay, the former mayor of New York, George Romney, father of Mitt Romney, who George Romney was the governor of Michigan. How did he use these fears and resentments to make himself a different kind of politician, to advance his political interest?
He had this gift for seeing the angers and the resentments that kind of roiled slightly beneath the surface. In that 1966 congressional election where he worked so hard, the Republicans picked up 47 seats. I mean, basically everyone who won on Lyndon Johnson's coattails in 1964 lost in 1966. I mean, basically we had 2 years of this heroically liberal Congress.
You know, by 1968, Nixon has taken a different tack, right? And has decided that there's a different way to elect Republicans.
Yeah. And the way he does it is he runs a commercial hour after hour after hour. You couldn't turn on the TV in the fall of 1968 without seeing Richard Nixon's commercial bearing the slogan, "The first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence." So he basically turns the civil rights argument on its head and said the people who were suffering deficits in civil rights were actually white middle-class Americans.
It's interesting. You note that the California primary of 1968 is remembered for Robert Kennedy's win on the Democratic side and then, of course, his assassination that very night. But forgotten, you say, is something that Nixon saw in the results of that primary, which was a sign to him that the shape of the American electorate was shifting. Describe that, will you?
There was a fellow by the name of Max Rafferty. I can't imagine a more obscure name in the annals of recent American politics. He was the education commissioner in California, and he had basically won office in 1962, railing against things like swear words in dictionaries in school libraries, you know, railing against progressive education, railing against even this teaching of evolution in schools. And he ran for Senate in 1968 against an enormously popular liberal Republican by the name of Tom Kuchel, who was the Senate whip. And no one imagined that California would turn out such a powerful senator who basically brought home so much bacon to California. And on the same day that Robert F. Kennedy won the California primary, Max Rafferty won the Republican primary. And in fact, he was on a glide path to winning a Senate seat. This guy who was very extreme, very conservative. And the only reason he was kept from winning was a newspaper reporter discovered a week or two before the election that he had dodged the draft during World War II.
But that was the general election, right? In the primary, he won.
The general election. He won resoundingly and absolutely stunned the pundits. Of course, the pundits were serially stunned. They were stunned over and over again by these conservative, by these conservative groundswells that they never saw coming.
So at a time when a lot of people looked at California and saw a nation embracing the return of a Kennedy and a liberal political philosophy, Nixon saw the beginning of a national realignment, right? I mean, is this when he embraced the Southern strategy? Yeah.
Yes, and political observers should have noticed it much earlier, because on election day in 1964, when Lyndon Johnson won California by a million votes, and this was seen as this kind of national consensus for civil rights, on that same day there was an initiative on the ballot against an open housing law, and that also won by a million votes.
We're speaking with Rick Perlstein. His new book is Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Rick Perlstein. His new book is Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. You tell a fascinating story here of how Nixon connected with his media consultant, Roger Ailes. How did they meet?
Roger Ailes was the producer, a very young producer, by the way. One of the ironies of the 60s was young people were seen as these kind of avatars of the left and the counterculture. But actually, Roger Ailes was younger than Tom Hayden. He was younger than Abbie Hoffman. And he was the producer of a local show in your own town of Philadelphia called The Mike Douglas Show. And he was a young whiz kid producer. And they had on, in this pivotal year, as I say, for Nixon's career, 1966, Richard Nixon in the makeup chair getting ready to go on The Mike Douglas Show. And Nixon is making small talk with this kid and saying, oh, you know, isn't it ridiculous, you know, that the things you have to do to get elected president these days, go on, you know, a midday show that watched by housewives. And Roger Ailes fixed him in the eye and said, if you think that this is silly, you're never going to become president. And Nixon immediately sent him to New York and ended up hiring him as his media consultant for the 1968 election, where he invented something that's still with us today, the kind of ersatz town hall meeting, in which basically a supposed cross-section of Americans grilled the candidate before a carefully selected audience friendly to the candidate. And that let Roger Ailes cut these things into these TV commercials that made Nixon look enormously smart, charming, heroic, all the rest.
So it was an entirely staged event, but it looked like he was being spontaneous and taking citizens as they come. And one of the fascinating things that you reveal here is that they would often bring somebody in who was too hard-edged, too openly racist, too brazenly conservative. The point being what?
Right. So there's a story. They're having one of these shows, and they're always done locally so that he could kind of spin local issues in local ways, right? And one of the people they had chosen for the panel turned out to be a psychiatrist. And Richard Nixon had earlier told Len Garment that he would do anything to be president except see a shrink. So Len Garment realizes he has this irrational hatred or fear or whatever of psychiatrists. He's like, we got to get the shrink off the panel. But it's the last minute, and they don't know what to do. They have to fill someone in the panel. And Roger Ailes, in this absolutely astonishing quote in Selling of the President, which, you know, I'm not sure people have paid a lot of attention to, says, well, let's get a George Wallace supporter, a cab driver. And Roger Ailes said he can say, all right, Mac, what are you going to do about the, and then he used a racial slur, that begins with N. You know, Roger Ailes recounting how they should get a cab driver. And the whole point of that was then Richard Nixon could come back and deplore that awful language, deplore the sentiments, but basically endorse the same kind of backlash politics that George Wallace was promoting, just in more polite language.
He could be anti-busing, but in a more reasoned way,
Sure, he could do it in four-syllable words and not say things like George Wallace, who said that we don't have riots in Alabama, we just shoot them in the head.
You know, one of the most memorable phrases from this period comes from Vice President Spiro Agnew, who was vice president under Nixon. And he referred to the media, the press then, as the nattering nabobs of negativism. Now, I think this comes from the congressional elections of 1970, I believe, when he and Nixon stumped all the way around all around the country for conservative senators and congressmen. Give us an idea of their approach, the rhetoric they used, and its impact.
Well, this is 1970 when the most transfixing event of the year happened in May, when four students were shot at Kent State in Ohio. Actually, 13 students were shot, but four died. And afterwards, these insurrections broke out on almost 1,000 college campuses. It was absolutely astonishing. And really, it seemed like America was on the verge of open violence, almost in the streets. And this was the year that Richard Nixon thought he could finally win a majority in the Senate. And he could finally kind of have his will in foreign policy by taking advantage of this social discord in order to campaign for conservative candidates. His point man in this actually was his vice president, Spiro Agnew. And he gave this absolutely scathing series of speeches. Now, lo and behold, it didn't succeed for whatever reason. And it's a complicated set of circumstances involving economics, certainly involving the Democrats co-opting some of that law and order rhetoric. The Republicans did terribly that year. And a lot of people make the argument that that was the trauma that finally brought Nixon to the brink of Watergate, that he couldn't stand this loss of control, that kind of democracy hadn't worked for him almost, and he was going to try other means.
Do you think, I mean, even though it was a failed electoral strategy, do you think that the impact on political discourse was significant?
Yes. What he did was he had kind of reverted to the rhetoric. He and Spiro Agnew, I should say, reverted to the rhetoric of a George Wallace in 1968. He had forgotten his lesson that you have to present yourself in a time of tumult as someone who is an antidote to the tumult. But he just looked like that year, and he made the Republicans look that year just like another part of the roiling Civil War. He didn't appear to be above the divisions. He didn't appear to be transcendent, and he was punished at the polls.
When Nixon ran for re-election in 1972, there were a number of Democratic candidates, and the strongest contender was Edmund Muskie, who veterans of the time will remember was the senator from Maine who had been the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats in 68, a strong centrist candidate. And Nixon clearly did not want to run against him. He preferred to run against George McGovern, the liberal from South Dakota. And he undertook to make sure that Muskie would not be the nominee. What did Nixon do to ensure that Muskie wouldn't be the Democratic nominee?
He cheated. And the most sort of fragrant tactics were basically ones that were meant to sabotage the campaigns of every Democratic candidate who he thought that he couldn't beat in November, so that he would be running against the one he thought he could beat, who was the anti-war. Well, they were all anti-war candidates. Basically, everyone, even Scoop Jackson, was saying we needed to get out of Vietnam. But he wanted to run against George McGovern because he seemed like the furthest left viable candidate. And so he would do things, or more accurately, his deputies would do things like stealing Muskie stationery, writing a nasty letter about how some other candidate had fathered a child out of wedlock, sending it out to the media, and making it look like the Muskie team was spreading smears about some other candidate. And then he would take another candidate's stationery, say Hubert Humphreys, and do the same thing. They had a word for it that basically you can't say in a family radio station, but it worked. Edmund Muskie eventually withdrew from the race because he was so mercilessly harassed by a letter to a New Hampshire newspaper that turned out to have been written by the White House. It was called the Canuck Letter. Later when they, you know, it was investigated and the Washington Post exposed that it had been written by the White House. The Canuck Letter basically was a letter to the editor saying, I, down in Florida, heard Edmund Muskie call French Canadians Canucks, which was basically the N-word for French Canadians in New Hampshire, who were an important part of the electorate there. And, you know, it was all made up. It was written by a White House aide. And it so incensed Edmund Muskie that he gave this passionate speech to defend himself right in front of the newspaper. And he either did or didn't cry during that speech. Some people think it might have been just a snowflake in his eye or something like that. And when that got out, and when people like David Broder put it all over the papers that this guy had cried on the stump, he was done for. Basically, these false flag operations, as they call it in the intelligence world, achieved their purpose. Hubert Humphrey thought that Edmund Muskie was sabotaging him, and Edmund Muskie thought Hubert Humphrey was sabotaging him, and no one knew that it was Richard Nixon's little underlings who were pulling the strings.
Well, Rick Perlstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Rick Perlstein's book is Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.